This morning, I want to go on a little journey with you through life. Let's rewind all the way back to the day you were born. You see a light at the end of the tunnel. You come out, you breathe your first breath, and you get your first spanking. The next several months, you're spent exercising this little body and this little brain just to figuring out how this world works. We breeze forward a few chapters of life, and now you're in school. You're forming friendships. You're learning how the rest of the world works, and history and math and science, and you're exercising that brain as much as you can, and your body is growing, and you're putting all that effort into learning and getting good or decent grades and forming friendships. Well, then you step out, and you're on your own. You're living life as a full-fledged adult. You've got a career. You might be starting a family. You might be buying a house, getting pets, having cars, and all that effort, all that work. And then you are doing everything in your power to be a productive member of society until that one day, that beautiful day when you can finally retire. And you've put all this effort. And you live life for that day, but then you retire and your body starts to break down. This body that you've been growing and nurturing every day starts to fail. And then your mind, your brain starts to go. And all of a sudden, in the final steps of this journey of life, mortality whispers in your ear, "What did you live for? What did you live for? What are you living for?" This morning, I want to ask you, what is your passion? What are you excited about? What gets you up in the morning? Why do you keep pressing on? I mean, at the end of life, what is all that living for? What is all that effort, all that learning, all that growing, all that dedication, all that training? What is it for? And what now? When you are at your death's bed, that question is going to come to you. And the time to work on the answer is not then. The time to work on that answer is now. So that's what we're going to look at today. And when it comes to life, I'm going to give you some encouragement you might not be expecting. I encourage you to live it up. We're going to be looking at some familiar verses later on, but I want to talk about this mentality. There is this mentality that, you know, life is too short. Enjoy it while it lasts. Live it up. And those who live by this creed, you know, they are going to savor the sweetest flavors of life. They are going to be soaking in the sweetest sensations, and they are going to indulge in the best this life has to offer. But what about when this life is over? They're going to be left, those who live by this creed of live it up, as we tend to think of it, they're going to be left with some fleeting memories. They're going to fade away at the same time they do. Let me encourage you to live it up in a more important way. You know what? I don't have to encourage you. Paul does it. 2 Corinthians, he's writing the second letter to his brothers and sisters there. Chapter 4. We saw some of these verses last week, but we're going to look at them from a different perspective today. In verse 16, he begins, "So we do not lose heart. Though our outer self is wasting away, our inner self is being renewed day by day. For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory. As we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. For the things that are seen are transient, but the things that are unseen are eternal." That's where he goes with all this. Paul's not suggesting that those things that we do see, those things that are temporary, don't matter. He is saying that, we are to take care of this body. This was given to us by God to take care of. We need to be good stewards of it. But he is saying that that is not our ultimate focus. And in fact, in the context of suffering here, what he's saying is, if our outer self is decaying and falling apart, what does that matter if our inner self is being renewed every day? See, he is focusing on something different. This is all about focus. This is all about what your eyes are set on, what you are living for. The great men and women of the faith, the people that God has used in amazing ways, They did it because they saw the invisible. I mean, check out Hebrews chapter 11. It talks about why they were used by God greatly is because they had something called faith. And faith is the evidence of things not seen, the substance of things that we are hoping for. It is seeing the unseen. They had their focus on eternity. Now, it might surprise you to find this, but I actually used to run track. And one of my events was like the 400 meter. I know, I don't look like it now, but I actually used to be a decent sprinter. And my coach had to tell me something that I wasn't expecting because I was used to short distance running. When you get to longer distances, he had to tell me, Aaron, quit staring at your toes. Look at the curve ahead. Keep your eyes on the finish line. Because this amazing thing happens, if you're running around and looking at your toes, your balance is going all sorts of off, and you end up tripping and falling face first in the asphalt. But if you keep your head up, and you look at the Olympic runners, they have their head up so far, they might as well be staring at the sky. You keep your head up and your focus up, you are going to reach that finish line so much faster and better and ready to win. Same thing happens in life. See, let me encourage you to look at life with eternity in view. Look at life with an eternal perspective. Because we are either seeking satisfaction here or there. And make no mistake, you can have one only at the expense of the other. If you are seeking satisfaction here, you will not have satisfaction in the next life. And if you are seeking satisfaction in the next life, it might cost you some satisfaction, some comfort, some passing joys here in this life. But everything in our life is determined by what we are focused on. Because in reality, without eternity in focus, the rest of life is what the Bible calls vanity. Everything we could live for in this life is vanity, which, to explain what that word means, it doesn't mean like, you're so vain. That's not where that comes from. It's not this vain of how I look. It is a passing waste. So the word that we translate as a vanity is from the Hebrew word for your exhaled breath. It's not even worth breathing back in. It's spent. It's useless. Now, apart from God, all is vanity. That's what the entire book of Ecclesiastes was written about. Get this. Solomon is the wisest man who ever lived. He had wisdom beyond all others. And yet he went through life looking for pleasure and satisfaction and purpose in everything else under the sun. And he wrote the book of Ecclesiastes as his final thesis on satisfaction in life and joy and purpose. And he goes through item after item after item that we live for in this world, and he finds it wanting, starting off with wisdom. He was known for his wisdom, so it's not surprising that this is where it all starts off, but he says, it only increases your sorrow. The more you see how broken the world is, the more you see how fleeting time is, the more you understand the way the world works, the more sorrow you're going to have in life. Then he goes on to, what about pleasure? Well, that's vain too, because all you're left with is some fleeting sensations. It is a short reward. You have it for a second, and then you're on to the next pursuit of happiness. There's a reason it's called the pursuit of happiness. Quite often, if you're pursuing it, you're never really going to have it, but for a moment. And then he talks about the vanity of hard work. In the end, somebody gets the payoff. Even if you work hard all your life and you accumulate all sorts of wealth from your hard work, and you've built up this empire, well, you're going to die someday, and somebody else is going to inherit it. What have you really gained in the end of it? He even talks about, like, okay, maybe it's about competition, being better than the next guy. The problem is, someone's always going to be better than you. Someone's always going to be the next best beyond you in some area. The likelihood of you being the absolute best is, I forget what the population on the planet is now, but it's in the billions to one. Not likely. I think we're at about 7. So not likely you're going to be the best of anything. But what about wealth? I mean, Solomon was the most wealthy king in the known world at that time. One of the most wealthy kings. And he had accumulated so much wealth, he could build cities to hold just his chariots. And yet he says that that is vanity. Because in the end, he still wanted more. It wasn't enough. It wasn't satisfying to him. It wasn't a good enough purpose. But what about like the altruistic honor? What if we live for honor? You know, I live an honorable life and people can look up to and respect me. Okay, number one, you're going to die at some point. And number two, everybody that knows you is going to die too. So really, how much is that honor going to last beyond your life? What have you gained other than other people? Eventually, he just says, here's the whole purpose of life. You ready for this? Love God, keep his commands. Somebody who lived through all of that and looked at all the vanity says, because guess what? That's what's going to last for eternity. We're born into this world naked. We leave wearing the same outfit. You've heard the old cliche, you've never seen a hearse hauling a U-Haul, have you? Because the stuff of this life, you can't take with you. It is here for a moment and then gone. It is not eternal. So that thing that you're living for, is that something that death can take away from you? Is that something that is here in this life for a moment and then pff, gone like a wasted breath? If that's you, God is calling you to expand your focus and refine it to something so much bigger and better than what you have set your sights on, for something eternal. Now, in a step away from his usual comedic routine, Jim Carrey said this in a very vulnerable moment. He said, I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see that that's not the answer. Think about this. Jim Carrey has lived out his dreams. He has more money than you and I could hope to see. And he says that wasn't satisfying. That was not enough. And maybe that's you. Maybe you've been looking at life, trying to get what you can take and trying to get satisfied in so many other things. Maybe you're singing along with Mick Jagger, I can't get no satisfaction. And that's your life. Let me tell you, as long as you keep the focus where it is, you're never going to have that satisfaction. You're never going to find that purpose. You're never going to find that value or meaning. It's not the answer. It's not enough. Paul goes on. He says, for we know that if the tent that is our earthly home is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For in this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed by putting it on, we may not be found naked. Now we're going to dig into this a little bit more in the following verses, but Paul talks about the difference between this life and the next. He compares this current life to a tent that will one day be destroyed. Then the life to come he calls a building, a house that is going to last forever. See, tents are only meant to be temporary housing, providing shelter for a short time, then packed up and either stored somewhere, or if you happen to belong to nomadic people, put back up in the next place you happen to land on. But a house is permanent. A building is better than a tent. It's fixed. It's always going to be there. I can remember going camping with my wife one summer and, you know, thinking we were going to sleep really well out in nature. It just so happened to be that that was when the magic cicadas come out. And for the entire night, we had them screaming right next to our tent. We couldn't close windows. We couldn't shut doors to keep the noise out. So we ended up having to stuff pillows in our hoodies around our heads just so we could muffle the screaming. And that is when I was convinced a building is better than a tent. Because if nothing else, it cuts down on the suffering. A tent will provide you shelter in a storm, but a house is so much more protective. A tent covers your belongings, but a house gives you a home to belong to. A tent, it'll give you something that you can spend some time in. But a house, a home, will give you something that you can invest in, that you can decorate, that you can make your own and return to time and time again. If Paul is right, that we are just a tent, that we are just living in a tent right now, that this is a temporary housing situation, some of us are glamping. Have you ever seen this? People take like TV screens and computers, and they've got fridges and microwaves and recliners and couches, and they're in a tent and they call it camping. No, that's glamping. You are not living life as if you were camping. I remember growing up, we used canvas tents, we had buckets, and we used fire. That was it. That was your entertainment. That was the whole thing. That's camping. And that's the life in a tent. It's only a temporary thing. It moves from place to place. It's not permanent. It's not set. So many of us are settling in when we have to recognize we're just living in a temporary housing situation. The only things that are worth living for in this world are the things that will live as long as you do. In other words, it's not things. It's people. It's God. It's our relationship with others. You are eternal. Get this. We are eternal beings going through a temporary experience in this life. Everything in this life is going to fade away at one point or another. You are eternal. Live for things that are eternal. You were designed for eternity. Paul goes on, talking about this whole tent and building contrast. For while we are still in this tent, we groan, being burdened. Not that we would be unclothed, as in not that we have the temporary things pulled off of us, but that we would be further clothed so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. He who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has given us the Spirit as a guarantee. He's for the second time, talking about tents. And for Paul, it's understandable. He was a tent maker by trade. But he is doing so much more than just using a convenient picture. Paul was drawing us to a clear illustration with that word tent. It literally means temporary dwelling. In this world, we are nomads. In this world, we are not at home. As Abraham said, we are strangers in a strange land. That's the way we walk through this world. We were never meant to settle down here. Stop glamping. This is not our ultimate destination. This reality is here for a moment, but one day it will come to a total renewal. What we know will fade away, and the new will be brought in. This reality is only short term. That means eternity is the ultimate reality. If you want to talk about things in the context of real and not real, which is real? The thing that always has been and always will be, or what is now present and will fade away in a moment? A temporary. Eternity is the ultimate reality. Let's live like it. Let's live life up with an upward focus towards eternity. Look, as Christians, we aren't looking to escape reality. He says, not that we would be unclothed, not that reality would be taken off of us, but that we would be further clothed. We look at reality, this life, as merely a stretch in eternity. And we are looking for not just this brief moment to be taken away from us. No, no, no. We look at it in the context of reality as a whole. And reality is eternity. He is saying we keep our focus on the whole picture, not just what's right in front of us. Stop staring at your toes. Stop glamping. Live it up for eternity. He says we get eternity added to us. So, we are always of good courage. We know that while we are at home in the body, we are away from the Lord. For we walk by faith, not by sight. Yes, we are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please Him. Whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please Him. That means that while we live with an eternal focus and a heavenward fixed gaze, that doesn't mean we wrap ourselves up in a Bible bubble and don't live in this world. God has us here for a purpose. And by the way, it's the exact same purpose as we're going to have for the rest of eternity, to please Him. See, this is just a stretch in eternity to practice that, to get ourselves ready for the rest of eternity. We might not be of this world, but we are still in it for that purpose. Our heads might be in the clouds, but our feet are still firmly planted in the ultimate reality of eternity. That's the life we are living. And so much of Christianity, I see it, and it's about being better here, being fixed here, having more fulfilled life here, finding more fulfillment here. We measure worship songs by their entertainment quality and how much emotion it makes me feel. We measure sermons by how much it makes me feel good about myself or how much I gleaned from it and it was interesting and fascinated me for about 2 minutes. Look, there's nothing wrong with these things. Those are necessary things that we need to be able to do those things within it. But if they fall short of refocusing us on eternity, they have failed God's purposes in our lives. We have to recognize that. We have fallen into what's known as deistic, therapeutic moralism. There's a God. He loves you, wants you to feel good, wants you to do good. We have missed the key point of history, let alone Christianity, that the God of all time, the God who is eternal, stepped into temporal humanity and died to change our eternity. From an eternity apart from him in hell, to an eternity with him in heaven, to change our eternity. The problem is not that we want peace, satisfaction, comfort, honor, and purpose. Those are all good and even great things that God designed us for. The problem lies in the fact that we are looking to have those drives fulfilled in a finite and broken world that is incapable of meeting those infinite and perfect needs that deal with our whole being. We think that all the answers to our problems can be found in this world, can't we? We're wrong. In his book, Future Grace, John Piper pinpoints for us the heart of this matter. Like Paul, Piper realizes that the goal of Christian life is that God be prized above all things. I could also say that the ultimate purpose is the praise of the glory of God's grace. The reason both are aims and both are ultimate is that prizing is the authenticating essence of praising. You can't praise what you don't prize. Or to put it another way, God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him. Sin is what you do when your heart is not satisfied with God. No one sins out of duty. We sin because it holds out some promise of happiness. That promise enslaves us until we believe that God is more to be desired than life itself, which means that the power of sin's promise is broken by the power of God's. All that God promises to be for us in Jesus stands over against what sin promises to be for us without him. This great prospect of the glory of God is what I call future grace. Being satisfied with that is what I call faith. And therefore, the life I write about in this book is called Future Grace, the purifying power of living by faith in future grace. The promises of future grace are the keys of Christ-like Christian living. By future, I don't merely mean the grace of heaven and the age to come. I mean the grace that begins now, this very second, and sustains your life to the end of this paragraph. By grace, I do not merely mean the pardon of God and passing over your sins, but also the power and beauty of God to keep you from sinning. By faith, I do not merely mean the confidence that Jesus died for your sins, but also the confidence that God will also with him freely give us all things. Faith is primarily a future-oriented assurance of things hoped for. Its essence is the deep satisfaction with all that God promises to be for us in Jesus, beginning now. You are in eternity right now. And if Jesus has changed you, your eternity has changed. See, when all is said and done, why did Paul not lose heart, as he said in previous passages? What allowed that renewal of his inner self to even be a possibility? It was because he had an eternal focus. When we focus on things in this life, we are spending the eternal for something temporary that eventually is going to turn to ash and dust in front of us. That's just a raw deal, isn't it? That's like trading the Hope Diamond for a dollar store candy bar. What in the world kind of a deal was that? We are giving something that has infinite value for something that is just going to disintegrate in time, leaving us with nothing after our funeral. But when you spend the temporary for the eternal, get this, God says, we get some of this world thrown in too. Jesus says this, Matthew 6:33. He says, but seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. Read that as, have an eternal focus. And all these things will be added to you. And all these things that he's talking about, he had just talked about food, clothing, and shelter, and pretty much anything else that you could possibly worry about, God's going to take care of. Either you're going to stop worrying about it because it's not that big of a deal, or God's going to take care of it because he is the one who sustains you for eternity. What if eternity didn't just matter in eternity? Because sometimes we get this mindset that, you know, eternity is going to matter when I die. What if it mattered right here and right now? If we have a perspective change here and now, shouldn't we also have a practical change in the here and now? As R.C. Sproul put it this way, right now counts for eternity. Right now counts for eternity. When we know we will live for eternity, we will live differently. In light of then, we change now. In light of then, we change now. Heaven and eternity with God is so much more than our eternal Caribbean resort in the sky. It transforms our presents, our hopes determine our habits. Think about what this meant for Paul's readers in Colossians. He said, if then you have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated in the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. For you have died, and your life is hidden with Christ in God. He's writing to people that were dying for their faith. Why in the world would they be willing to die, to face torture, loss of home and loved ones, to be burned alive or thrown to ravenous lions? Why would they go through that? Because they already consider themselves dead in this world so that they can live in the next. They were willing to sacrifice absolutely everything in this world that they would gain it in the next, because they recognize that life is just a stretch in eternity. Part of why Jesus came is to change our perspective of eternity. Instead of being destined for hell, now we have the secure hope of eternity with him. The Puritan Thomas and Watson put it like this: eternity to the godly is a day that has no sunset. Eternity to the wicked is a night that has no sunrise. And that is exactly where Paul turns his focus at the end of our section in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. We'll pick up again back in verse 8. Yes, we are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please him. For we must all appear before him, before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what is done in the body, whether good or evil. The word he uses there, that judgment seat, is the word bema. It was a white throne that a public official would sit on, and they would judge in disputes between two parties. And they would determine who had done right and who had done wrong. They would reward those who had done right, and they would punish those who had done wrong. And while the bema seat, that is just for us Christians, we are still going to go through some sort of judgment, but the good news is it doesn't deal with condemnation. It deals with who gets rewards and who doesn't. But this brings us to a really unpopular topic. Like, this is not going to get us a whole bunch of follows by talking about judgment, is it? But whether we like it or not, judgment is coming. Whether we like it or not is irrelevant. In a court of law, a judge doesn't only pronounce his ruling so long as the defendant is okay with being accountable and is accepting of the whole process. See, we're the ones in the wrong. God's the one who's the judge. Look, there is an eternity waiting for you. Are you living like it? There is a real, literal place of God's joy and blessings and the glory of his presence called heaven. But there is also a very real place for filled with his wrath and suffering and sorrow called hell. And the suffering there, the likes of which no human tragedy could ever come close to comparing. Hell is no joke. The people there, they're not partying. They're not living it up, let me tell you. They aren't drinking. They aren't doing drugs. They aren't having sex. They aren't laughing. They're screaming, "Help me, I'm burning." Hell is no joke. And there is a real eternity waiting for those who don't live life with an upward focus, who don't live it up with our eyes on eternity. And if that's you this morning, please take this moment to hear the gospel message, the good news that this could be something that you don't have to worry about anymore. You will never have to face it. Jesus died for you and took that on himself in your place. But look, Christians, we never have to worry about that. We know that God died for us. We have that confidence, and you could have that confidence too, that now we get rewards. Not only do we not have to worry about hell, we get rewards. And we will appear before the Bema Seat, the great white throne judgment, where God's going to measure everything that we've done in life, every word that we've said, every thought that we've had. Did it please God? Did we really live it up? Did we live it up? Live it up. Live with a life with an upward focus. Live with your eyes fixed on eternity. Ask yourself, when you're standing before the judgment seat of Christ, is this really going to matter? In eternity, is this going to matter? You were designed for eternity. Let's live like it. So we might ask ourselves, okay, but honestly, what does this really change other than, you know, my perspective? Everything. Your focus changes everything. Our pursuit of position, power, and wealth is traded over for finding our ultimate fulfillment in God. It makes every temporary resource a tool to be leveraged for God's eternal kingdom. Our self-serving relationships are transformed to opportunities for justice, mercy, love, and righteousness. Doing good works for applause is deepened to the natural outpouring of action that comes from a close relationship with God. Pursuit of accumulation is converted to advancing others. Dismissing our own failures becomes being held accountable for our actions. The illusion of self-sufficiency is demolished, but the fortress of depending on God is built in its place. And by the way, we don't have to worry about being politically correct or hurting each other's feelings. We can now be open, honest, and speak truth to each other because eternity matters so much more than your emotions. Eternity is so much more important than how you feel about what I'm saying. We get to live with that perspective. And the minefield of autonomous and subjective morality, that's turned into a clear path where God has set markers saying this is safe. That is some of the difference that it makes. It changes our priorities. It changes the way we view people. Instead of things to be clung onto, there are things that we're willing to sacrifice for the eternal kingdom. And we now see everybody as a candidate for redemption. They're an eternal soul. You don't know just a normal mortal human being because everybody's going to spend eternity somewhere. And that changes the way we interact with each other, doesn't it? It changes the way we look at time. We use fading moments to accomplish unfading ends. It changes our perception of pain that we talked about last week. We recognize that this is only for a time. Guess what? The perseverance of the church has always been based on an upward focus. We sang a song this morning, "I'll Fly Away." Oh, glory, I'll fly away. When we talk about some of the older songs, you know, on Jordan Stormy Banks, I mean, we have this eternal perspective. The reason the church was willing to go through persecution the way that they did is because they knew this life was only a brief span in eternity. It changes the way we view pleasure. Not that we don't enjoy things, but we recognize that they are just whetting our appetite for the pleasures to come. They are just a little sampling The greatest joys in this life are a sampling of what God has in the future, and poor ones at that. It changes the way we view purity, that we're not looking at what we do as trying to please God. It's us grooming ourselves for the life to come. And here's where it really hits home. It changes our personal identity. Instead of being identified by a job, by a name, by a family, by a culture, by anything else in this world, we are now identified by our eternal destination. You know, if nothing else, during this quarantine, we started to realize what really matters in our life, didn't we? Our jobs can fall apart. You're still you. Your family, you're fed up with them, I'm sure, if you've got them at home with you. They don't define you. Your house, everything about you, your hobbies, all the things we have not been able to do right now, they don't define us. Our eternal perspective does. We change in that we now have hope. The whole world can be falling apart and we are still as secure as ever. As long as we live life with an upward focus. Live it up. God, thank you. Thank you that we are not just doomed to this short and painful life. There are some sweet joys in it, Lord. We thank you for those blessings. But thank you that we are not just limited to this. Thank you that you have put eternity in our hearts. Now, Lord, would you put eternities in our eyes? Would you let us see it? Would you bolt our focus onto eternity? Don't let us settle for the things that are just apparent because they're right in front of us. Keep our focus on those things that are eternal. Open our eyes to be able to see it. Some of us for the first time, some of us for the 100th time, Lord, but let us see it clearly today. Thank you for the opportunity that we have right now to refocus on eternity. God, would you continue to draw our eyes to what is ahead? Lord, thank you that we now can have courage. We can have that confidence, that boldness of knowing that this outer self might be wasting away and decaying, but Lord, you are still renewing us every day in grooming us for eternity. Lord, would you continue that work in us now? We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Let us lay aside every weight, friends, and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the founder and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is seated at the right hand of the throne of God. Let us live with an eternal perspective. Live life with eternity in your eyes. Live it up.